HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 81, recorded live Tuesday, September 11, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott addresses listener questions about Vista 64.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. A little bit of a strange show because it's about 9:30 in the evening on Sunday night, and I'm sitting here in the Embassy Suites in Bellevue, getting ready tomorrow to start my first day on the job at Microsoft. And I am more than a little bit nervous and more than a little bit nauseous about the whole idea. I worked at my last job for almost 6.5 years, almost 7 years. Previous job before that was six years. Previous job before that was 3 or 4 years. I'm not a guy who takes moving jobs lightly. I usually work for a couple of months at a time at a job. And, the whole kind of moving your life into the next phase thing has kind of got me all torn up inside. Plus, I've been wandering around Microsoft as a visitor for, with a visitor's badge for, the better part of a decade. I know a lot of people there, but I'm acutely aware of what I don't know. Even though I was under a number of NDAs for things like the MVP program and the RD program, there's so much stuff that's going on inside that I don't know about that I'm going to find out about. So the idea that there's this precipice, this transition that's going to happen tomorrow at the NEO, the new employee orientation, is the kind of the power of that is not lost on me. I suppose I would have the same feeling if I was going to work for Sun or IBM or Adobe or one of these big companies, these big behemoths. One of the things that's attractive to me about going to work for the developer division is that even though the company is, I don't know, what is it now, 60,000 people or some huge number like that, there is still a small kind of community feel in a couple of buildings that are taken up by the developer division, at least on campus in Redmond. So I know that from an IT perspective, I'm going to work for a very, very large company and things are going to go a lot slower than they did before. At my last company, you could just, be friends with the IT guy in charge of phones and then you would get a new BlackBerry when you needed to get a new BlackBerry. But I suspect it's a little more complicated at Microsoft. But rather than me rambling on about my emotional pain around going to work for Microsoft and how weird it's feeling, I am going to do a little bit of a redo and expand on last week's Vista 64 show. So we can call this the listener mail, viewer mail episode. Some good comments came out up on the blog with regard to the moving to Vista 64 episode. So let's read a couple of comments and I'll try to expand on this and hopefully add a lot more information in this show that wasn't in the last one. Carl and I tend to play off of each other and sometimes we get off on tangents and segues and non sequiturs and the conversation doesn't necessarily go where I want. So I think I'm going to pledge in the next couple of months to start outlining Hansel Minutes even more structured to make sure that I get to say what I feel needs to be said about a particular topic. So comment here from Abdu, who says, I expected some talk about the benefits of moving from Vista 32 to 64 or from XP straight to 64, but the issues presented were more of Vista in general. So, Scott, why are you using Vista 64, other than just being an early adopter for MS technologies? It's tough to find that balance between being an early adopter, staying up on the technology. What does it mean to be an early adopter? Why are we always going for the next big thing? For me, I didn't move to Vista 64 just because it was the next big thing. I was consistently and regularly on three different machines running 2 gigs of RAM. On one machine, I had 4 gigs of RAM installed. I actually had an IBM or Lenovo ThinkPad T60P, had the 4 gigs of RAM installed, but of course Vista 64 could only see about 3-something of it. And there's also, of course, the 2 gig process boundary. And I was regularly running into that because I would run many, many virtual machines, and I would run out of handles. I would run too many copies of IE. I would run too many copies of, you know, whatever. Once you get Outlook, Visual Studio, and IE all running together, a couple of VMs and Firefox, you start bumping up against those limits, especially with big VMs. So I needed that extra headroom, and I didn't think initially that going from 2 gigs to 4 gigs would really make a difference. But I can say that in my experience on Vista 64, I've been able to run, you know, 4, 5, 6 VMs all at the same time. They're all running, of course, on external hard drives. I haven't had any thought about memory problems, handles, or any of the weird kind of stuff. Even under Vista 32, I had had issues where I'd open up Internet Explorer and a menu would disappear after I had too many versions or too many copies of IE running. And I just haven't had those issues under 64. From a stability perspective, I've had, once we had the initial memory instabilities, got that handled during our overclocking, I haven't had any Vista panics or anything freaking out. The only things that have crashed on Vista 64 for me have been the things that you kind of expect to crash ordinarily, which unfortunately is Explorer.exe, which seems to crash if, you know, network latency is too slow, or you remove a hard drive while you're looking at it in my computer, that kind of stuff. But I have been really impressed by the stability. So I moved to it because I really needed the memory. I have 4 gigs, and I might want to go up to 8. It is significant, of course, that there are different SKUs within Vista, and not every SKU supports the same amount of memory. But I believe that you've got Vista 64 support on each edition, except each edition of Vista has a different amount of RAM that they can support. So, for example, Vista Home Basic supports up to 8 gigs, which is still a lot, but supports up to 8 gigs. While Enterprise Ultimate supports 128 gigs or more. Now, there's no PCs out there that could get that much RAM physically on the board. Right now, the issue is how much you can actually stick together on a board. But Basic and Home Premium support different amounts of RAM under 64-bit than Ultimate. Also, when you order Ultimate, you get 2 disks, a 32-bit disk and a 64-bit disk. Other disks have 64-bit versions, but when you buy it off the shelf, you get 32-bit, and then you have to call Microsoft and get them to send you a disk. But, you know, for the most part, those are identical. Okay, another question here, Robert G. I was expecting you to talk about the development experience on a 64-bit box. Like, what does not work? What are the showstoppers? IIS behavior, is anything slower? Applications take more memory? 64-bit.NET apps take more memory? Things like this. Here's the best part. Do you plan to do another show on this topic, or was everything just peaches with development on 64? Well, so honestly, I found that after making a couple of just real simple realizations that, in fact, everything was peaches. Sounds silly, and I'm not trying to paint an overly happy picture of Vista 64, but I honestly haven't had any major issues to speak of. I did blog about one thing, which was just understanding that things can be compiled 32-bitness and 64-bitness. If you go up to my blog and search for the word bitness, B-I-T-N-E-S-S, I don't know if that's a word, but if you search for it, you'll find that article. And so basically, I get Vista 64 Ultimate set up, and the first thing I do is I go into Programs and Features, and then I click on Windows Features, turn them on and off, because Ultimate, Enterprise, and Business are the only SKUs that have IIS installed. Now you can get the web dev, right? The Cassini, the small web server that's built into VS 2008, VS 2005. But I really wanted to have IIS on this box, so I go into Programs and Features, turn Windows Features on and off, and there's a little trick here because they give you a tree control with checkboxes. So you get a multi-level tree control with checkboxes. It's important that you actually have to open up the tree control. You can't just click the checkbox at the highest level and assume that that will automatically cascade down and check all of the other checkboxes. Even though that's intuitive and that happens on many tree controls, on the particular one I'm talking about in the turn Windows Features on or off dialog, it in fact does not work that. It's a little weird. So you got to go down in there and turn on things like IIS6 management compatibility if you want to use any of the scripts that you might already have for talking to the IIS6 management objects. Turn on the management console and stuff like that. So that was the first thing for me to learn about. that's not a 64-bit specific thing, but remember, this is the first time I really started developing on Vista, so nothing 64-bit yet has come up so far in this story. So then I had to pick IIS7 pipeline modes. There's the integrated pipeline where you can do .NET kind of ISAPI filter type stuff. You can have things that are like HTTP modules on steroids. We'll do a show on IIS7 at some point. I had to pick that pipeline mode, and I've got the command lines up on the blog there. And then I set up a couple of things. No problems at all. Everything works exactly as I thought. And then on my particular application, in this case, it was DOS blog, and I was compiling it under Visual Studio 2008. And when I ran it, I got a bad image format exception. So here, now we are at a example of something that could potentially go wrong when you're doing 64-bit. So you're doing your .NET development. Suddenly you hit bad image format exception. Not a very good exception, kind of vague. In this case here, I was using a thing called the basic date picker. It's just some control, an ASP.NET control, but it does some p-invokes or something internally that is not 64-bit compatible. So this is a real common thing. You've got a library that you compiled using the AnyCPU, quote, AnyCPU, all one word, end quote, compiler option in .NET, and this is how it's supposed to work, right? You compile your app in C# or VB, and you get an assembly, and it just works. And the PE header, the portable executable header, handles this, and it automatically loads the 64-bit framework or not, and everything just works. And in my experience, 99.5% of all the, you know, .NET applications I've tried work fine. In this instance, there was some p-invoke call or something crazy that they were doing. And it turned out that I needed to do one of two things. Okay. I needed to either find a 64-bit version of this assembly, and there was one available. I compiled against it and it worked. Or, and this is a little more obscure, you actually go into the advanced settings of a particular app pool, and there's an option called Enable 32-bit Applications. And this is really interesting. So on 64-bit Vista, you've got the option to run your app pool. That's w3wp.exe. Remember the IIS7 worker process as a 32-bit worker process or a 64-bit worker process. Sounds kind of counterintuitive, but if you remember when we had that transitional point between ASP.NET 1 and ASP.NET 2, we had to make separate app pools to say, I want all of my 1.1 applications running in this app pool and all of my 2.0 applications running in this app pool. That kind of separation of concerns, that separation of we can only have one version of the framework running in one app pool at a time, it's the same kind of thinking. Now, it's different in the case because we're basically saying I want a 32-bit application unmanaged, loading up and hosting managed applications, or I want the 64-bit version. But that idea that you might potentially in a hosting environment have some 32-bit applications and some 64-bit, it really all depends on whether or not that application is doing something funky with regards to either a p-invoke or a com call to some component that just doesn't work under a 32-bit process. Now, under Vista 64, the only thing that really gives you the hint at any point that things are different under the covers is when you right-click on the clock and bring up Task Manager and take a look at the list of process names. Any process that is a 64-bit process just looks like, you know, foo.exe. But a 32-bit process says foo.exe*32. So that's the only hint that you have that something different is going on. Those are 32-bit processes that are being run in kind of that emulation mode, that Windows on Windows 64 mode. So if you turn this app pool into an enable 32-bit applications app pool, suddenly you see w3wp.exe*32 appear in your task manager. Of course, you can make multiple app pools and you can set this differently for each app pool. So that makes a very interesting kind of multiplicity of, you know, kind of a Cartesian product of different app pools. You could have 32-bit app, integrated pipeline, 32-bit app, classic pipeline, 64-bit app, integrated pipeline, 64-bit app, classic pipeline. So without even getting into framework versioning versus, you know, one versus two, you could potentially have four different app pools running with these different features. So that was, you know, something to think about. Not a huge deal if you're only hosting one app, but something to be aware of that, you know, the process starts out as either 32-bit or 64-bit. So that was an important thing to be thinking about. Now, there is a tool that comes with Visual Studio. You can open up a Visual Studio command prompt and run cor flags, coreflags.exe on an assembly, and you can see whether or not that thing was compiled as a 32-bit assembly or not. And I get to run that on my basic date picker, and I could see the difference. And it turns out that the PE header will always say, you know, PE 32, almost always say PE 32, but there's a little 32-bit flag. And that 32-bit flag basically is asking the loader to say, you know, I really insist that this be run in a 32-bit process, or I really insist that this not be run in a 32-bit process. And you can flip this flag, actually, the core flags.exe, you can actually force it. But of course, theoretically, the user, the developer, rather, who wrote that assembly knows best. Ultimately, though, that is a suggestion. That flag is a suggestion. It's not a rule. For me, unless you're doing some funky pinvoke stuff, and I don't mean to always say funky before pinvoke, but unless you're calling unmanaged code in a way that is not 64-bit compatible, then you really shouldn't bump into these kinds of things, especially under ASP.NET. I could see potentially with a WinForms application, you might be doing some funny painting things or something as far as talking to device drivers and things. But for ASP.NET straight talking to a database, I just can't imagine why you'd have that problem. So for me, converting DOSBlog to run in 64-bit was a matter of finding that one assembly that was not 64-bit compatible and swapping it out. And I would suspect that in most environments, that's rare. Now, if you are using third-party libraries and those third-party libraries are using obfuscators, sometimes the act of running an obfuscator on an assembly suddenly forces the bit rule. So you might have written your code in a perfectly reasonable any CPU kind of a way, but the obfuscator flipped it to being 32-bit or 64-bit. That may be what happened in the basic date picker case. But you know, if you're not doing that, you're not going to have to worry about it. But if you are using obfuscators, you might want to talk to your obfuscator vendor to see if that's something that is the case. Some of the other questions came up about drivers. You know, what kind of effort was it to move to 64? Now, I would say if you've only got 2 gigs of RAM, you know, your system has 2 gigs of RAM, there probably isn't a benefit to moving to 64-bit. That's just my opinion. I would say unless you have 4 gigs of RAM or you really want to have more than 4 gigs, there's probably no benefit. But as a memory hog, that's, like I said before, primarily why I wanted to do it. Now, I work with Jeff Atwood on the computer, and we did a complete inventory of our hardware, and we said what 64-bit drivers are available and what are we willing to jettison, what piece of hardware are we willing to toss. Now, I was lucky because the only hardware I think I had to get rid of was a camera, like a web camera, and a scanner. But it turned out that my Canon Pixma MP5500 multifunction had a great 64-bit driver. I think it's reasonable to assume that some of the larger companies that are out there, the big ones like the Epsons and the HPs, will have 64-bit drivers. But it's also fair to assume that if the piece of hardware is a couple years old, they might not have bothered. Now, the Pixma line of multifunction printer scanners is fairly new, so I was pleased that my year-and-a-half-old, two-year-old printer scanner thing had a perfectly good 64-bit driver, worked just fine. But, you know, my little Logitech Quick Cam, it seemed reasonable that the thing was that old. Of course, on 64-bit Vista, you don't want to spend a lot of time trying to hack into it. It seems kind of a silly thing to say, but I really was concerned about stability, and I was teased by a number of listeners and blog readers I purchased an iPhone recently, and while I was able to get iTunes installed on Vista 64 without too much trouble last week, when I tried to activate the iPhone, I didn't bother to Google first. I figured if iTunes was installed, why wouldn't the iPhone be able to activate? Well, of course, iTunes includes a number of things that are driver related. The first being CD burning. It includes a tool called Gear that is an SPTD driver for burning. And that isn't compatible with the CD burning driver for Daemon tools. So my CD burning doesn't work. But apparently also the driver that talks to the iPhone for the purposes of activation also doesn't work. And so I was kind of teased mercilessly by you people, tongue in cheek. And I think the gentleman's name, let me see, I'm scrolling down here. Here we go. Mike Van. Mike Van, earlier when I putting together the Vista 64 machine, said, don't install anything on the machine. Use VMs. Mike Van was the guy who kind of convinced me that this VM way of doing things was the way. And when I recently published my 2007 tools list, I've got about six or seven virtual machines. I've got one for Rails development. I've got an Ubuntu machine. I've got an old Windows 95 machine for syncing with my Newton. And I've got a machine that I basically just will install anything in. You know, it's a XP 32-bit machine, virtual machine, and I'll throw anything in there. But I did what Mike said, and I'm not installing crap on my system. So here I go and I install iTunes, and Mike says in the comments here, and I quote, "Your X64 box sounds like in another 3 months it's going to be due for another reinstall because of all the crapware that's being installed and patched to make everything work. It's so sad all of us have spent so much time playing these games just to get our system and software. How many wasted Hansel minutes did you spend trying to get this to work?" I thought this was funny. And he basically said that this is another example of how the software industry is progressing too fast. Now, I have to admit that it's definitely going to be enthusiasts, people with a lot of RAM, and, you know, people like myself that are going to install 64-bit. But I just don't think it's going to be that way in a year or two. When Service Pack 1 comes out, more people start installing Vista. You know, they're going to start installing 64-bit. And I think, of course, when 64-bit's the only way to go, they'll do it. And I would say that I don't think that the Vista 32-bit to 64-bit transition was quite as smooth as the Mac transition, the Mac OS X universal binary transition, which I think was done fairly smoothly. But if you talk to Mac developers, there was a heck of a lot of development pain in the background. There were a lot of developers that were told that this needed to happen. You need to get those universal binaries out right away. But I will admit that the way that they came up with the transition plan did seem a little bit simpler. But of course, Apple controls the hardware. I think that's one of the things that I think when people compare Apple and Windows, they forget that Vista has to support a much broader world of hardware, a much broader world of devices than the Mac does. And of course, Mac tends to end of life things a lot quicker than Microsoft does. Now, Mike here, he says he had to install Vista X64 three times since it's released. But I think that he's overstating things a little bit because I really haven't installed that much stuff on the system, and I've been really careful not to install anything that installs a driver. For example, I wanted to install BioShock, but BioShock installs a rootkit, and I didn't want to be a part of that, and it didn't seem like a safe thing to install. But I did install Steam from Valve Software, and I installed Half-Life 2 because Half-Life 2 had a native 64-bit process. And it installed in a well-known directory, and it didn't put any services or anything on my system I needed to worry about. So I think that the kinds of stuff that people install that make their systems unstable are things like things that run in the tray and things that run within the explorer.exe process. I am really judicious about what I decide to load up into explorer.exe. I think the only thing that I've installed so far on my 64-bit machine is Subversion. Subversion has a 64-bit process, so that gets hooked into my right-click menu. Other than that, let me see, Subversion, Daemon Tool 64, which I've been very happy with for mounting ISO images. You know, that's about it. There's not a lot of stuff installed on this machine, and I really do feel that it's stable. So, the iPhone rant that I kind of had on the blog recently was kind of an interesting one because people were trying to figure out, well, is it Apple's fault for not supporting 64-bit, or is it Microsoft's fault for not having perfect 32-bit support? Now, considering that the issue is a driver, and considering also that iTunes clearly sucks egregiously on 32-bit Vista, I don't think that the argument in the case here that is 64-bit is the problem. So I think it's a completely specious argument that, you know, iTunes on 64-bit doesn't work, therefore 64-bit sucks. I think that iTunes started sucking at iTunes 7, and there's not many people who can argue otherwise. With the iPhone, I ended up getting it to work just by syncing it with my Mac. I brought my contacts over with Plaxo and brought that into the address book. I brought my calendar items over with Spanning Sync and sync that to iCal, and then everything syncs fine. It's all happening in the background, and really, in this case, Google Calendar is ending up being the hub. It's unfortunate, but I will give Apple this. Their stuff works great with their stuff. The iPhone works fantastic as long as I just don't let it talk to my Vista machine. And that'll be I'll give them that. Actually, I think I'm probably going to give the thing, back. I'm going to see how it works up here at Microsoft for the week. But I did find out that I can pull the SIM card out of my iPhone and I can plug it back into my HTC Dash running Windows Mobile. So if I find out that the, you know, the mobile is really going to work for me much better, I'll end up using that, but really not an X64 issue. All right. Let me see if I missed anything else. Oh yeah. A couple of benefits of 64-bit. People have been saying very vague things about, well, there's other benefits like security and reliability of 64-bit. So I wanted to really dig into that a little bit and find out what is the difference? Why is 64-bit considered more secure or more this or more that? So I went up and I found Jeff Jones' security blog. Jeff Jones works for Microsoft. And he found three benefits to Vista 64 that are unique to 64. The first one is hardware protection. It was called NX protection, no execute protection. This is where you can actually mark a chunk of memory as not being executable. So if a buffer overrun happens, they can't actually jump to that point in memory and start executing. You also call it DEP, data execution prevention. Actually, a funny story. Go take a look at Omar Shaheen's blog. He just found out that the latest version of Microsoft Money, this is a Microsoft product, Money 2008, won't run with DEP on, which is lovely. It actually says in the release notes, you have to turn off DEP to get Money to run. Very uncool of that product to not work. That's why I gave Money up a while back. So with Vista, no execute or DEP data execution protection is an opt-in basis where an executable actually has to mark itself as being opt-in. I want to be a part of this. On 64, that's turned on by default. So all code by default is being protected by data execution prevention unless you explicitly go and either turn it off or turn it off on a process by process basis. And then there's this big discussion that's going on about patch guard. Patch guard is a big part of the Vista 64 security story, because when you're doing driver development, typically you might want to jump into the kernel and basically patch it up, get hooks in there such that people will call you rather than calling other things, making chains in the kernel. Chains of intercepts, and that's not allowed in Vista 64. It's called patch guard, and turns out that they're going to come up with a secure way to do that theoretically in Vista Service Pack 1, because a lot of driver manufacturers got upset when that happened. But those kinds of things prevent blue screens. They don't stop blue screens, but they do prevent a number of driver related blue screens. And there's also another thing where when Vista starts up. In the past, in previous versions of Windows, memory is very predictable. All of the different modules get loaded about the exact same place in memory so that you can do evil things, because stuff that you expect will show up there. In Vista, the memory is kind of randomized. There's a number of different opportunities for stuff to show up in different places. I think it's like 256 different combinations of places where modules potentially get loaded in that early point of Vista starting up. There's also the driver signing. I think the number one thing that has made Vista 64 more stable for me personally is that you can't install unsigned drivers, so you can't get that that suspicious driver from that weird little company that you never heard of for that funky webcam that cost $5 and came with a tiny 3.5-inch CD-ROM, and you're not really sure where the drivers came from. I remember running through the program Auto Runs from SysInternal. Auto Runs is a fantastic program. You need to definitely Google for that and check it out. And looking at all of the different things that got started up on my system, got started up during the startup process, not just stuff that's in the startup folder, but things in the run key in the registry. And then that caused me to go down on my old Vista 32 machine and into the System 32 and also into System 32/drivers folder. And I encourage you to do this on your Vista 32 machines. Do a DIR descending by date. You want to see the old stuff. And I ended up finding really, really old drivers sitting in there. And it turned out that I had installed some stuff that was using like NT4 style drivers from like the early 90s. And those were ending up in process space. Of course, you can use things like Process Explorer to see those things, and found a number of really, really old drivers that got loaded by a lot of the, as Mike says, crapware that I was installing when I was playing around. You know, you put a piece of shareware on your machine, you see that strange blue gradient, the I call it the WISE install gradient, because you can see those things. It's the old style installer. That's the first sign that maybe you don't want to be installing that thing. But I would just punch through install it anyway. And I'd end up with a lot of crap on my system loaded into memory. Maybe not necessarily running, but you just don't know how those things get unstable. I used to have my Vista 32 machine, just Explorer would just disappear, just poof and be gone, you know, 4 or 5 times a day. I'm just not seeing that on 64. I don't know. It's probably a combination of some of the protection that 64 offers, but also the fact that I'm treating 64 as a whole new world, and I'm a lot more careful for installing stuff that really ought not be on there. So I think that finding a balance between what Mike was saying and then what I'm saying, you know, don't be afraid to install a driver if it's available and it's from a big reputable company. But also, if you can use all that RAM, use VirtualPC, use VMware. A number of readers suggested that I use VMware because of their USB support. So unless the program, and I do not know this in the case of iTunes, but I wouldn't be surprised because I've had a number of programs that will detect that they're running in a VM. But unless the program can detect it's running in a VM, why not do that install inside of a virtual machine first and see if that's a safe program? I got an external drive. I've got these 7 VMs. It's really made things a lot smoother. And being able to load a VM and not have to shut down Outlook and not have to shut down DevEmv and the 16 different instances of IE and the 4 different instances of Firefox that I've got running all adds up to a positive experience. So kind of in conclusion, development-wise, there are a couple of little things around Bitness that were something I had to think about. Mostly it was IAS 7 type stuff, and it was mostly common sense, and I'm documenting it as I go along, so you'll find Google support out there. You'll find Google help for these things. But 64 from a development perspective, VS 2008, it just worked. The compilers just worked. I'm going to do an episode and maybe a blog post on multi-threaded, multi-processed MS build farms, being able to spin up multiple MS builds in parallel, so parallel MS builds on quad proc machines. That's not really a 64-bit thing, but it's more of a quad proc thing. But I haven't had any problems. I've developed a number of applications just in the last, in little applications, compiled a whole bunch of source code in my quest to read more source code. Haven't had any problems pointing to 64-bit when it came to .NET development. So, you know, if you want a crap load of RAM, you got 4 gigs of RAM or more, you like VMs, you know, I don't think if you've got hardware that was made recently, if you've got a Core 2 Duo or a newer AMD and brand name hardware, I think it's worth a try at least. You know, and you could do what Atwood told me, which is like pull out your C drive, put it somewhere else. I'm not a big fan of dual boots. I'm just not. Pull out your C drive, get another C drive, and try it out. See how it works. Oh, yeah. And the other thing that we saw was some chipsets of motherboards have trouble installing Vista 64 when you have 4 gigs installed. Not all chipsets, but just a couple. I've heard a couple of reports of this. So people basically drop the RAM down to 2 gigs, they do the install, and they bring it back up to 4. I didn't see that, but a couple of people emailed me that they had that problem. So that's what I got to say. Now it is 10 o'clock at night, and I'm going to work tomorrow at Microsoft at 8:30 in the morning, and I'm scared out of my mind. So, dear reader, dear listener, thank you for spending this little bit of time with me, and I'll hopefully come up with a number of cool interviews and try to get you guys information. Email me and ask any questions that you've got that you might be stumped on that you think I could go to Microsoft people and find out. If there's a topic that you think just isn't being covered in the kind of depth that you want, you know, what do you want to see now that you've got me on the inside? Someone emailed me and asked me if they were going to be folding me into Channel 9. That's a totally different group. One of these days I'll do a show on how Microsoft's kind of organized from a developer division perspective. Right now I work for a guy named Simon Muzio and he works for Scott Guthrie. So there's me, I work for Simon, Simon works for Scott. And I talk to Scott all the time. So there's no marketing person. I don't work for marketing. I don't even work for what's called developer platform evangelism. So I'm just kind of like dev div's kind of private blogger guy. So while we will be on Channel 9 occasionally, and I've got a relationship with the guys that run Channel 9, don't expect to see any of the content that I do like fold in. It's not like the blog is going to become a part of Channel 9 or something like that. I'm kind of an independent right now. If there's things you want to see, email me, let me know. And this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. See you next week.